Hey, I'm Jake Brennan, and I want to tell you about Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I host. Disgraceland tells the stories of musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly. Fleetwood Mac, Nipsey Hussle, Cardi B, Ozzy Osbourne, Taylor Swift, Tupac, The Beatles, Amy Winehouse, Jay-Z, The Grateful Dead, and so many more. This is not the music history you've heard before. This is an uncensored, immersive look at the lives of musical icons as seen through the crimes they've committed or that have been perpetrated against them. Did Jerry Lee Lewis murder his fifth wife? What really happened to Sam Cooke in that seedy motel at 3 a.m.? And how did the Rolling Stones wind up sleeping with the First Lady? Wait, what? New episodes of Disgraceland drop every Tuesday with bonus episodes released on Mondays and Thursdays. So get in, buckle up, and join me in Disgraceland. Available right now, wherever you get your podcasts. Rock and roll.
Looking back on these last 20 years of my life and thinking of all the people that have come in to my life and are no longer part of my life, and, you know, and just thinking about the thing, you know, the lessons that you've learned from the relationships that you had, you know, they might not all have ended well, but hopefully you will have taken something away that will have changed you, you know.
Hi, this is Lowell Tolhurst, co-founder of The Cure.
This is Budgie, co-founder of The Creatures, drummer with The Slits, and Susie and the Banshees.
Welcome to Curious Creatures.
Life after punk.
You may think you know the territory,
but we drew the map. How's Spinal Tap of Block Party been then? Ours was always exploding guitarists.
Called John.
They were always called John as well, yeah.
No, I mean, I feel like we've been quite, you know, we're not Motley Crue or something. It's, you know, I feel we've always been quite pleasant. That's what I was saying. I think we've always treated each other respectfully, you know, even at times of distance. You know, I don't think it's ever got to fisticuffs.
I did.
But there's still time. There's still time.
There are some bands we know that make a whole reputation on, like, you know, right? Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. Maybe it wouldn't be a bad thing to clear the air, but then, you know, I don't think regular violence is something that I should be extolling. So yeah, I don't know. I think it's good.
No, you're right.
That we're not in that place. But you know, I think we've been going for such a long time now. You know, I've known Russell, the founding member, for such a long time that I think we have an understanding about what is important ultimately, and I think we're on the same page with that.
So. Well, that's good.
I did that thing you should never do, you know, is look at your own history on some trail somewhere, and it goes to our old friend Spiz Energy. That's where I went to.
Oh my goodness.
And okay. Spizzles and Spiz Oil, and there was a photograph. It was courtesy of Spiz, you know, so I click on it.
Yeah.
And there I am, I mean, all the Banshee party and extended family crew.
Right.
You know, I think it was a wedding anniversary or some celebration of maybe our sound guy and his wife. And yeah, so people I've met recently and some I've met very recently after a long time, and people who I was married to and an ex-girlfriend. And you just realize it was a really tight-knit little group, and we met on a nightly basis, you know, or daily basis, even when we were not on tour. And then the band kind of became only together when we were on tour.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the big change, I suppose. That point you change, dynamics change. And I suppose then it's always about, well, is the music honest? Is the reason, as you just said, Kelly, you know, for doing this? It must be odd when the reason longevity is there because you've changed so much that your original reason for being there is not recognizable to yourself, but it's what the fans want. Does that make sense? It's kind of like what you've created takes on its own life, and it's, you know, okay, well, should we go with this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess in our situation, I founded the band with Russell, the guitar player. You know, when I was at Sixth Form College, I would You know, that was when I met him. I would go to his house and we'd write songs together. And really, that relationship is still there. You know, we've had highs and we've had lows, but we still respect each other musically. You know, whenever I play with him, I feel like I'm being shown something I hadn't seen before. So as long as that keeps happening.
Respect is a very necessary thing, I think, because once you become disdainful of each other or whatever, it's never going to work. I don't know. I mean, Shirley Manson said it to us. It's always your family, the band. Whatever happens at the end of the day, you're always family somewhere along the line. You know?
Yeah, I mean, that's the one thing that I would say as a 40-year-old to, that, you know, looking back on these last 20 years of my life and thinking of all the people that have come in to my life and are no longer part of my life. And, you know, and just thinking about the thing, you know, the lessons that you've learned from the relationships that you had, you know, they might not all have ended well, but hopefully you will have taken something away that will have changed you, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not really in contact with very many people from the start of my life. And that was no, I guess for no real reason other than, I guess, when I started touring for the first time, it was just so disruptive. You were just, I would only ever see my family because we were away for so long. But I didn't, I don't know, I didn't mind that. I was doing something that I loved and yeah, I wouldn't have changed it. But yeah, sorry. I mean, I don't know. Looking back as a 40-year-old, that's how I try to think about the people that are no longer in my life. You know, just be thankful for the times that you did have. I don't know. That sounds like a Hallmark card, doesn't it?
No, it sounds genuine and kind, but you know, the particular profession we find ourselves in is, you're not destined to be around people. I mean, I can remember coming back home after my first tours, and it wasn't just like, you know, romantic relationships that don't flourish. It was like every relationship.
Yeah.
Because I would go down to the pub and, you know, see people that I knew from growing up and they hadn't seen me for 6 months or a year or whatever. I don't know anything about their life. You know, it's like, it's gone. That burden's gone. And I find...
Did you have to sign autographs when you got in the pub?
Not that I recall.
I just remember that because they'd only ever seen, you know, he's on the telly.
Seen you on the telly.
He'd been on Top of the Pops a few times, you know, BBC television. And similar when MTV, because you guys were on MTV.
Yes, very early on.
Like, you took MTV over, right?
Yes, basically.
Some respite from REO Speedwagon or whatever. Mention no names, of course. I like David Lee Roth. I thought he was a good guy. But the way he did the splits, you know.
But before my time, but I can imagine the vibe.
Yeah.
When did you first get out to America, Callum?
I mean, we first got out to America before we recorded our first album, Silent Alarm. I think in 2003, I think we did shows really early on in the States, like college radio things, I remember. Being like, I think 2003, 2004. Yeah, I mean, it was an amazing time going from wanting to do this for so long to actually doing it and being flown to other countries, you know, staying on people's floors or in kind of shitty motels, but we were doing it. We were really like a band. And it wasn't until like 2 years later, I guess, when Silent Alarm came out that we kind of saw what was possible. But I do remember those first few years just being excited that they wanted us to go everywhere and do all this stuff. We didn't really anticipate any of that stuff.
We have a friend that we had on the show a while back, James Murphy from LCD Sound System, and he had an interesting theory about that sort of, you know, life of discovering the world, you know, in a completely different way and going on tour. He said he would often meet people on the road and start talking to them and realize that they were actually maybe 10 years older than him, but he looked about 10 years younger than them and felt younger because this kind of life, you know, for whatever reason in the end, actually keeps you youthful. You don't suddenly decide, oh, well, this is going to be my life and it's charted out now until I'm 65 and then I'm going to, you know, retire and it's going to be. So it actually, it has that effect. And what do you think about that?
I mean, I would agree. You know, touring, you know, turns you into like a teenager and it kind of keeps you there. You know, you're Peter Pan with all of your friends, traveling around the country, traveling around the world, just having these adventures, and
right.
You know, and it's someone's job to wake you up, and it's someone's job to get you from A to B. You know, you haven't got any responsibilities, and it's a great way to live, I think, as a young person. But I do think, really, for me, having children kind of changed that way of looking at touring. Now it's clearly because my world's changed. I mean, I want to be home. You know, I don't want to be on a tour bus. You know, I don't want to be in a hotel room. You know, like, I don't want to miss anything. You know, like Eden, our 3-year-old, he was born just before the first lockdown. He was 6 months at the first lockdown. So for that whole year, you know, I wasn't allowed to travel, but it was perfect because we had this newborn, and every single day I could see that he was developing and becoming something. And I guess for me, you know, what is it like, the great reset, isn't it? Like, I guess lots of people post-COVID are maybe looking at their lives a bit differently and trying to get the balance of work and home. And so, yeah, it's something that I'm kind of struggling with, I guess, internally, if I'm honest right now.
It's that thing where you would have had to make a difficult decision. Baby just arrived, but you know, it's that time again. I've got to pack the case.
I know. For the first time ever, you know, because you know, you always find, you know, when you're in the middle of a 5-week tour somewhere and you haven't been home, you always kind of fantasize about what it would be like not touring, and to have that then like forced upon me and to actually quite enjoy it was like, oh, okay, maybe there is a different way to do things.
I felt very guilty because I was away. I started touring again when I teamed up with John Grant and his little band, and touring around Britain quite a lot as well, and Europe. And the children were, let's see, they were kind of like 5, somewhere around there. But I was actually getting more sleep, you know. I hadn't slept for like 3 years, right. It felt like, you know. And I was just like, oh, I need sleep. And it was great. Suddenly I had days just wandering around in cities that I'd been to many times, but I was like feeling a little lonely, missing home, but actually trying to make the most of the experience as well.
Well, that's what I'm looking forward to, having some lions, actually.
Yeah, you see, there's not all going to be, it's got good sides to it as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, because we have a handful of shows booked this year, I think it's going to be a real test just for me personally to see what that feels like. It's so, yeah, let's see what it feels like. I think I'm kind of building up in my head a little bit.
You're doing these shows with, I've forgotten the name.
Paramore.
Yeah. Lol, you know, I only came across them recently, but it sounds like you're doing like the 6 big venues down the country.
Yeah, we're doing 6 in the, a handful in the UK and then a handful in the States. So,
okay.
And then it looks like we're going to be going to Australia at the end of the year. So it's just about enough, really.
John did opening for a similar tour, like the NEC, and we ended up at like the O2 Arena in London with Elbow.
Okay.
And so the guy and the guys. And for me, it was just seeing a touring from another point of view again, you know, where the crews, you certainly say that the O2 Arena, where everybody like drives into the open venue and the crews get to work at 6 in the morning building the thing. And it was the smallest stage I'd ever been on because we were opening, and these stages are kind of like tightly built for the headline act.
Yeah, they're lovely, aren't they? Although Guy has a room in the studio just near me, so I bump into him quite a lot. He's
a lovely man. Yeah,
he is a lovely man. Yeah, he's a really lovely man. I think that's all I was going to say.
Okay. I thought we were going to get some inside stories on Guy's early morning pre-studio habits.
Some dirt on elbow, that's what we want. Yeah. For me, the children thing was kind of, you know, it was force of circumstance because I had left the band and then my son was born. So I'm like, okay. I ran away and I came here and I'm like, okay, I'm going to spend these years bringing him up, which is what I did, like Patti Smith, you know. And it wasn't until he was a teenager that I said, okay, now I can go on tour and I can do things like that.
Yeah.
And it paid a lot of benefits, absolutely, because we have a very good, close relationship, you know.
It's very encouraging to hear that, because that's what's most important, really, is, you know, that I'm here and I'm present. You know, like it wasn't easy bringing these children into our lives, and you know, that's only the start of the journey. And you know, I'm under no illusions. I know how I was when I was a teenager. I know that we have troubles coming, but I want to have a real relationship with my children.
I think if you have the real relationship first, no matter what troubles come, because you're right, they always come. You have a way to navigate them. Where I didn't have a way to navigate my troubles with my father because I had no relationship with him. So, you know, I just would bypass him all the time because I thought, well, he's not going to help me.
Yeah.
He doesn't have the answer for me there, so I'm just going to go, you know. And I did. And that's what formed the band, because The Cure became my family. But, you know, for my son, I looked at it like this, like, well, what didn't I like with my upbringing? What didn't I like, and why do I expect that he would go and like that if I, you know, had it happen for him? So I made everything go the opposite way, you know, and mostly it's worked, I think. So
I feel really, you know, grateful just that I have the opportunity to be with them. You know, I had this situation, had family come early on somehow, hand in hand. I've got a little picture in front of me. It's the only thing I have is like my mum and my dad from a photo booth, and they quite young couple at that point. But you know, my dad, I only saw him at the weekends because he was just working all the time. He worked all the time to kind of make sure there was enough to put food on the table, and I know he was a real loving man. He wasn't absent, but he was just...
No, he was present, right? He was really present.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, my father was there all the time, but he wasn't present. You know, that's the difference. I don't ever remember a hug or a kiss or any, or even a long talk or even a handshake from my dad.
There were different times as well, you know, so the hug and the kiss was hard to come. You know, me and my little boy were just kind of like, you know, just hug and kiss all the time. It's like,
yeah.
Make sure, you know, it's like just every day, you know. Like,
absolutely, absolutely, you know, absolutely.
Love you, love you, love you too, love you more, love you more.
Yeah, I make a point. Every conversation I have with my son, you know, I tell him I love him at the end of it. And it's the same for him, you know, so it's...
That's lovely to hear. My dad wasn't... You know, he was a very kind of, he was a very loving and very gentle and kind person, but, you know, he was a man of a certain era, so maybe he wasn't so in touch with his emotions, you know, coming from a different culture as well, kind of navigating all of that.
Right.
You know, he was never mean. He was, you know, and I saw that. I saw some uncles that were mean to their wives and were horrible to their children, and that was never my dad's vibe. But you know, he was just kind of proud man, really. But it was interesting. He actually told me just before Christmas, because he went to Nigeria for Christmas. He told me that he was proud of me, and that he'd, you know, we've had our troubles as a family, but it was very healing to hear that from him.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, that's something that he would never have said, but I think time has softened him in a way. So,
and I guess it goes to show that we can all grow.
Absolutely,
have that happen. You know, so that's great. That's the best story I heard this week.
Oh, that's
no, it really is.
My dad just said to me, whatever makes you happy, you know, because every time he would say, so, right, you're going to art college. What do you get at the end of that? And I go, like, well, I don't know. You become a famous artist, right? Okay, well, if it keeps you happy. And then, of course, I didn't finish that course. Then I joined a band. Well, okay, that's maybe not the most ideal thing. But he never said, you know, it was never negative about anything.
Yeah.
And I think that's, I just want to encourage, support, be there.
Yeah. The only thing I ever said to Gray about that was, I said, I don't mind what you do with your life. You know, whatever you want to do is fine by me, but I'll just suggest that you do something that you love, because then you'll probably be quite good at it, you know, and then you might actually have a life from it, you know. So that's all I ever said to him about it. And so far, I think he's pretty much doing what he loves.
I mean, but yeah, that's what's most important to me with both of them. And I'm seeing it with my daughter, Savannah. She's 6 and she's obsessed with drawing. It's like all she wants to do is kind of draw. And I'm excited because, you know, my parents weren't really so supportive of creative pursuits. I remember I had to lie when I joined the, when I was a teenager, when I joined a band, and then I had to lie again when I dropped out of university to pursue, you know, to accept a record deal. Like,
was that because you felt they just wouldn't understand?
Yeah, I mean, with the deal, I mean, I didn't tell them when I dropped out, but then I told them when we signed a deal, because I felt that would lessen the blow.
bank account now.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, they weren't into it at all, but it wasn't really until they started seeing me in magazines and on TV and their friends started seeing me that it was like, they suddenly became like cheerleaders, and now they're like they're like the biggest cheerleaders, but...
Now they're at the front of every gig I play, yeah.
Yeah, every show we do in London. But, you know, I mean, I understand. They've come from a different place, and so, you know, they have a whole different set of rules about what, you know, they only want the best for their children. To them, the best is, you know, like an architect, a doctor. Anything that isn't that is like...
Right, it's not going to work.
No.
It's funny, I had zero relationship with my dad, it worked the other way with my mum. My mum became super supportive, you know. She was the person that gave me love of art and literature and stuff like that, you know, because she was heavily involved in that. And then when it came to start the band, and I said, you know, I had like this job, I was going to college, but I had this job as well. And I said, Mum, I'm going to leave, you know, the job, and I'm going to become a professional musician full time. I said, but it means, you know, I have about half as much money straight away as I have now. And she went, okay, let's do it, you know. And then she would get the Melody Maker every week and scour it looking for, you know,
awesome
mentions and stuff. And I would come down to breakfast and she would talk to me about, I like that new single by The Clash. Like, that's good. And I go, really? Yeah. So it was like,
wow.
She set the controls right, you know, for me. In that way.
We've probably done it already, you know, just by kind of achieving that little dream, you know, buying the NME or whatever it might have been, whatever publication you read religiously from cover to cover, you know, when you were like,
yeah,
I'm thinking, well, not really thinking one day, but like suddenly one day it happened.
Kind of amazing.
You know, and getting to America, college radio, meeting the kids on the campus.
Yeah. Yep. That was a fun time. I have to remember that. I have to remember those years, you know, because it can all go so fast. It's such a blur. But, you know, I have to remember those years because that's when we probably felt most like a team, really.
Yeah, yeah.
We had our backs against the wall and
right.
No one knew who we were, but we knew who we were.
And yeah.
I never think back about that time so much, but it was probably when we were closest. So.
It's nice that you say you know, maybe a lot of us have to reset ourselves a little, you know, and hey, you know, maybe there's like chance that I can, you know, my children might see me play, and I never thought I'd have children, never mind the children that might come out and see me play.
Yeah.
And of course they'll come out and go like, oh, it's really noisy what you do.
Yeah, that's what Eden said. He said it was too loud. He didn't like it. but I'm glad that they both saw it, so.
I got the chance this year to go and see my son play his first like nationwide tour. You know, he was like,
oh wow,
oh yeah, you got the other way around.
Yeah, he's like three of them in a van. You know, 13,000 miles, and you know, taking the gear in and out every night. The funniest thing for me was that I went to see him on a few of the shows. You know, playing the same clubs I played 40 years ago.
Oh, wow.
Except they're just called something different.
Yeah.
It's got a different name. I walk into these places, I go, I know this place.
Did you carve your initials in the bog, you know, in the toilet door?
Yeah, I went to look in the dressing room. Look, under here it is, under the sink. Yeah. No, it was great. And I loved doing that, you know, and I could see. I spent my whole time at the gigs I went to with him not looking at them playing, because I know all their songs and I know how they play and I know all of that stuff because I've seen it again and again.
Yeah.
But I'd watch the audience, you know, and that was great because I could see that look in the audience that we all know and when they get it and they want it to work and stuff and they're in, you know.
Yeah, it's a two-way thing, isn't it? It's you're inviting them in. Yeah. And the energy that they give you makes it better. And
yes, I always think it's like a self-referring, like a feedback loop of love and gratitude backwards and forwards, you know?
Yeah.
Is that a Hallmark card thing?
That's another Hallmark card thing right there, yeah. I'm going to copyright that one, though. Yeah. Feedback loop of love.
Quick.
you'll make a lot of money off that one.
Well, it would be nice, yeah.
Tell me about it. Yeah, I mean, money makes the world go round.
If you get on the TV, well, as soon as you're on the BBC, then you must be okay, right? You've got, like, it's all in the bank.
Yeah, you must be a millionaire. If we saw you on the telly, you must be a millionaire.
Can
yeah.
I borrow £50, please? Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, I mean, I don't know. Money. There's no way to talk about money without not coming across crass. So
it begets more, doesn't it? It certainly is the undoing. I think we've both left bands, and the thing that happens is that money becomes the topic.
Yes. Yeah.
And every book I've read, every memoir, every biography is there's always some kind of courtroom rumbling at the end of it.
Yeah.
And that's so depressing.
Yeah.
Well, there's two sides to that whole thing, I think, with money. On one hand, you're right, it's depressing about how that should be the thing that divides our art. The other thing is, it should be that art and all of that creation is a lot more recognized and recompensed than it tends to be, you know, because you know, it's like, I always think this about London, right? And, you know, I'm probably wrong now because I've been back for a few years. But I always think of the amount of money that bands and music make for England. And there's like a handful of venues in London and they're all pretty crap, you know?
Well, there are fewer. There are fewer venues, maybe.
Why wouldn't they do any kind of investment in what is basically one of the main exports, you know?
Do you think, like, the touring circuit here is crap? Do you think, is that compared to theatres and stuff in like the States? I mean,
yeah, I think so in general, because I think that you know, I am not, ladies and gentlemen, a right-wing capitalist, but I think in the States a lot of the time they would look at a situation like that and think, well, okay, this stuff is bringing in money. Let's build a good place for it.
Yeah.
Let's do, you know, they're a bit more pragmatic about it. Whereas in England, they're like, oh, those noisy oikes making that sound. Well, we'll put some more money in Lords and they can go whistle, you know?
The the space in Britain, the spaces of the venues that you start when we kicked off and every pub had a band on.
Yeah.
And that's changed because the bands were not bringing in the money. So
yeah,
they needed more space for people to eat, and that was more important. And so venues changed.
Yeah.
Were, you know, the idea of it. We had to play, like, you played strip clubs, right? Because the venues didn't want you in.
You know, like places like, you know, in the Netherlands, in Holland and stuff like that, you know, the government builds venues and builds rehearsal facilities. I used a rehearsal facility in Amsterdam a few years ago that was better than any place I've ever had in England, and it was built by the government. Yeah. So there's no state sponsorship for it. That's what I mean, you know. In England, not really.
Yeah, I know that with the Conservative government, you know, we saw with the kind of the Baylites that it was clear that they weren't prioritising people that worked in the music industry. Like, I think because traditionally, I guess, people in the arts are left-wing, so they don't support them. But
right.
I remember there being a huge furore, you know, with the lockdowns, you know. Lots, you know, I'm lucky that I'm a musician that has been going for a certain amount of time, so there was a certain amount of security. But think of all those young artists breaking into the industry, or all the crew members that like aren't touring, and
yeah.
I just thought that was so shocking that there was no real support for those people.
No,
you know, I just remember thinking, I guess young people were always going to take the brunt in with COVID. You know, it's that's left a
right.
a mark, like or like a ripple that's going to keep reverberating, and it's going to keep, you know, we're going to be seeing the after effects of what those years, you know, have done to people for a long time, I think.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely.
I suppose we can't have it both ways. Maybe that's what it is, you know, that we can't have meaningful expression with a price on it. You know, it maybe the two things really don't sit well, you know. That
I think it's also it's political expediency, you know, in England and in Europe generally. You know, there are fundings for different things and that which you wouldn't get out here, but what drives the model out here is pragmatism. Hey, we can make it work and we can make some money. Let's do it. So it's the other way around. But if you fail, you're going to be one of the homeless people that live at the end of my street, you know, because that's what happens, you know.
There's no safety net.
No safety net at all, you know, which is pretty frigging frightening, you know.
Did we want a safety net when we started out?
Well, no, but then we were young and stupid. So know, it's like you don't. You don't want a safety net back when you're 20 because you think you're A, you're going to live forever, and B, nothing's ever going to be bad, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's a nice depressing topic to end on, isn't it?
Is it always this much of a giggle with you guys?
Always.
We're not professional in any shape or form. We've just kind of fallen into this in the last couple of years.
No, it's good. I really enjoyed it. Like, the only people I've spoken to today are like my children, so it's nice to speak to some adults about something.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm sorry that, you know, we're the best you got today.
Yeah, no, it was still incredibly enjoyable, don't worry.
Okay. Love to the family and good luck on the touring.
Thank you very much, guys, for having me.
Curious Creatures is created and presented by Lol Tolhurst and Budgie.
Producer, Joe Wong.
Producer and audio designer, Dan Didier.
Executive producer, Mark Cates.
Associate producer, Sophie Wild.
Digital marketing, Margie Taylor.
Art and logo design, Justin Thomas Kay.
Music production, Jackknife Lee.
Curious Creatures is on the web, and you can access us at www.curiouscreaturespodcast.com.
And you can reach us on Instagram and Facebook at Curious Creatures Official, Twitter at Cura Creatures.
To find more of the best music podcasts, visit doubleelvis.com or follow at doubleelvis on Instagram
or at Double Elvis on Twitter.
Curious Creatures is a production of LXB LLC 2023.